You're listening to the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine. This is The Insulation, what 7 decades of closed-door deliberations reveal about Federal Reserve independence. On March 13, 2026, a federal judge quashed grand jury subpoenas the Department of Justice had issued against Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell. The court found that the subpoenas were served to pressure the chair into lowering interest rates or resigning, and that the government had produced no evidence of a crime. The stated pretext, testimony about a headquarters renovation, was, in the court's assessment, pretextual. The mechanism was notable. Unable to direct monetary policy through the institutional architecture Congress had built to prevent exactly that, the executive branch attempted to rout around it through criminal process. The question this raises is not new. It is the question the Federal Reserve's own closed-door deliberations have been answering, in various registers of candor, for 7 decades. The institutional architecture designed to answer it in advance is specific. The Treasury-Fed Accord of 1951 ended the wartime arrangement by which the Fed pegged Treasury yields. Congress reinforced the structure with staggered 14-year terms for governors, insulating any single appointment from a single administration's reach. This legal and governance architecture was built deliberately to make one claim answerable in advance. The Federal Reserve holds statutory authority to set monetary policy without presidential approval, and no single administration controls a majority of the board. A second, distinct layer of reform followed from different institutional pressures. Humphrey Hawkins created formal reporting requirements driven by congressional demands for accountability, not executive constraint. The decision to preserve and eventually publish FOMC transcripts, reached in late 1993, was catalyzed primarily by a Justice Department shift in FOIA policy and persistent House Banking Committee pressure, not by concerns about White House influence. The 2012 adoption of an explicit 2% inflation target was framed internally around expectations management and forward guidance efficacy. Each of these transparency reforms added genuine public accountability, but their motivations were congressional, legal, and communicative in turn, not further expressions of the same anti-executive design that produced the accord and the 14-year terms. The officials who built and maintained this architecture did not describe it as an aspiration. Arthur Burns, serving as chairman during one of the most politically turbulent periods in the Fed's modern history, stated the principle without qualification. Quote, "In establishing the Federal Reserve, Congress deliberately decided that the national interest required that the central bank be insulated from political pressures stemming either from the Congress or the White House." This was not rhetorical cover. David Eastburn, president of the Philadelphia Fed across 2 decades, testified from direct observation. He never witnessed an FOMC decision deliberately slanted for political purposes. Thomas Meltzer, president of the St. Louis Fed, located the guarantee in the structure itself, an architecture carefully crafted by Congress to minimize the influence of short-term political agendas. These men are stating what they believe to be true. The FOMC transcript archive makes those same deliberations available, released on a 5-year lag from sessions where these officials spoke without expecting the public to hear. The architecture of independence is not an abstraction. It is a set of specific claims about what enters the FOMC room and what shapes the decisions made there. These are testable claims. We went into the archives. The door that was not closed.
The public architecture of Federal Reserve independence, statutory terms, a congressional mandate, formal distance from the executive, rests on a premise that the institution itself has articulated consistently across decades, that the White House does not enter the FOC room as a deliberative consideration. It is worth being precise about what that claim covers and what the archive can test. Legal independence, the Fed's statutory authority to set the policy rate without presidential approval is not in question here. Operational independence, the absence of direct executive commands over specific decisions, is also not what the transcripts address. The dimension the institution's own public framing stakes a claim on is narrower and more specific. Deliberative insulation. The assertion that executive preferences do not function as first-order inputs shaping what the committee discusses and how it weighs its options. Burns, Eastburn, and Meltzer were not describing legal authority. They were describing a deliberative environment. That is the account the archive must be asked to confirm or contradict, and the evidence it yields speaks to whether executive preferences were explicitly present as deliberative considerations, not to whether the outcome of any given meeting was dictated by political pressure rather than shared economic information. The August 1978 transcript is among the clearest documents in the record. The meeting concerned a proposed tightening action, a discount rate move intended to signal resolve against accelerating inflation at a moment when the Carter administration had publicly committed to its own anti-inflation program and the Treasury retained coordination interests in any rate adjustment. Paul Volcker, then serving as vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, addressed that specific proposal in terms that no procedural account of independence anticipates. Quote, "All of these political considerations that have been raised are very valid, and there's no point in doing it unless we really have White House support and Treasury support." White House and Treasury support as a prerequisite, not for monetary policy in the abstract, but for this action at this moment, given the operational dependencies between a discount rate adjustment and the administration's stated program. Volcker did not describe the political considerations as understandable or flag them as a communications challenge. He called them valid, a deliberative endorsement of their weight in the committee's calculus for that specific instrument at that specific juncture. The significance of the statement is not that it articulates a general theory of executive dependence. It is that a vice chairman of the Federal Reserve treated executive buy-in as an operational condition for a concrete policy move, and the committee did not contest the framing. Publicly, Volcker framed the Fed's accountability as constitutional, running to Congress, not the executive. The closed transcript observes no such distinction. The insulation frame, if it applies at all, does not apply here. 2 months later, Chairman G. William Miller pressed the same logic further. Quote, "If we indicate that we really intend to take other kinds of actions that we haven't consulted with the President about, it might be read as counter to his program and superseding his program. Would that get us into hot water?" The phrase "hot water" is doing precise work. Miller was not asking whether the action was analytically correct. He was asking whether it would trigger executive reprisal, and he was framing prior consultation with the President as a norm whose violation carried institutional costs. The question implies a coordination expectation, that major action required presidential awareness, not merely post hoc notification. Governor Nancy Titas, at the December 1978 meeting, added the intelligence dimension. "The committee faced a situation," she observed, "where it's only going to take the outsiders about 2 seconds to figure out that because of our monetary policy, the president can't achieve his objectives." Titas was modeling the external read of internal decisions in real time, calculating how quickly the political implications of stated policy would be decoded. This is not the behavior of an institution that considers presidential preferences irrelevant to its process.
The FOMC Insight Engine measures convergence across 3 institutional registers: staff analysis, committee deliberation, 0 to 1, where 1 represents complete alignment across all 3, and lower scores indicate greater divergence between what was produced internally, what was said in session, and what was released publicly. The convergence score across those 3 registers for the period examined here sits at 0.35.
Below the 0.4 threshold, the engine calibrates against the corpus-wide distribution of register alignment, as indicating significant divergence. It signals that the voices speaking inside the room and the voices speaking outside it were not inflecting the same account with different emphasis. The registers diverged significantly. The pressure did not seep into deliberations as ambient context. It was treated as a first-order operational constraint, requiring active management. And the committee's live question was never whether the White House mattered, but how to navigate its preferences without either full capitulation or public confrontation. If the pressure was acknowledged this candidly in closed session, something happened to those acknowledgements on the way out. The filter. The mechanism that interests the archive is not the pressure itself, but what happened to the language describing it. Committee members named executive interference in closed session with a candor that never appeared in published accounts. What follows is how that candor was managed, from the FOMC table to the institutional record. The answer begins with Burns himself. On August 16, 1977, with speculations circulating publicly about whether Federal Reserve policy had been calibrated to political rather than economic objectives, Burns turned his attention not to the substance of the charge, but to the documentary evidence that might confirm or refute it. Quote, "So the political dimension here is, I think, quite obvious. To get hold of the memorandum of discussion, to go through it, and see whether that memorandum of discussion validates or repudiates that speculation." Burns was not describing external scrutiny. He was describing his own review, his intention to examine what the internal record would reveal if it became accessible. Burns was alert to what the internal record could reveal if it became accessible, that the memorandum of discussion might either validate or repudiate the speculation circulating publicly. The chairman who acknowledged political pressure in closed session was simultaneously the chairman who reviewed the internal record for exposure. That awareness is consistent with the broader dual-track communication pattern visible across the period. A prior investigation documented a parallel divergence. The institution's internal archive contradicting the external characterizations that public figures drew from its history, the same record serving as both evidence and material to be managed. Volcker extended the strategy to staff analysis. In December 1978, still serving as vice chairman before his own ascent to the chairmanship, he articulated the governing principle. Quote, "What we did not want the staff doing is coming in and saying that X is consistent and Y is inconsistent. Then, if we get asked, we'd have to quote that." The most charitable reading of this instruction is institutional rather than concealing. Staff should not be placed in the position of rendering judgment on whether the committee's chosen path was analytically defensible, a role that belongs to the principals, not the analysts. That rationale is consistent with the language. So is the alternative, that explicit consistency mappings, once produced, would have become quotable records of the gap between stated objectives and chosen policy. The archive cannot adjudicate between these motives. What it can document is the effect, whether to protect the committee's deliberative space, preserve negotiating flexibility, or prevent accurate staff work from becoming a quotable record of the policy path. The result was the same. A February 1980 report accurately identified administration economic targets as unattainable, and the governing principle Volcker described meant that finding would not enter the record in a form the committee would later be compelled to cite. The filtering mechanism intervened between rigorous analysis and institutional communication at exactly the point where the two registers diverged. 3 decades later, Greenspan offered what the public record had always offered: credibility as closure. In September 2002, he observed that the institution had built sufficient standing that the notion of moving for political reasons had not seriously arisen in a very long time, other than among an inevitable number of commentators. The skeptics were inevitable and therefore dismissible. What the archive records as an actively managed strategy the public register reframes as a question that has ceased to be worth asking, the claim of irrelevance as the final stage of the dual-track strategy. The convergence score across the three registers, staff, committee, and public, measures at 0.25, deeper into the significant divergence range than the 0.35 recorded for the deliberative episodes above, and the lowest in this investigation. The staff register is the most suppressed, the public register the most dominant, and the committee register sits between them, the layer where private acknowledgement lived before the filter removed it. That distribution is not noise. It is the quantitative signature of a controlled separation between registers. The mechanism Burns and Volcker described, operating at institutional scale, regardless of the motives that sustained it. What the archive has not yet answered is whether the filtering shaped only the record, or whether it shaped the decisions the record was built to document. The direction of the delay. The archive's answer is qualified but directional. In documented episodes, the filtering shaped not only the record, but the decisions it documented. The mechanism visible in those episodes is neither reversal nor ideological capture, but something more structurally durable. Temporal accommodation, the delay of policy execution in specific windows when the executive branch had made its preferences clear. The research evidence characterizes this pattern as partially supported. The deliberative record confirms members were aware of political timing, but no clean counterfactual establishes how much of any given delay derived from political deference rather than from genuine uncertainty about the macroeconomic outlook, data lags that complicated real-time inference, or the consensus-building dynamics that naturally slow collective decision-making in a distributed committee. These competing explanations are not refuted by the evidence. They coexisted in the transcripts alongside the political acknowledgements. What the archive can establish is that members named political timing as a live constraint and structured their language around it. It cannot apportion responsibility between that constraint and the others with precision. The distinction matters analytically. A committee that reverses its analytical conclusions under pressure has formally surrendered. A committee that delays their execution while maintaining the framework intact can always defend the eventual action as data-driven. By the time the data finally supported what political convenience had already chosen, the accommodation had become invisible in the record.
Staff analysis during these episodes identified the tension explicitly. In early 1980, the board materials were precise. Experiments with the quarterly econometric model suggested there was a reasonable chance of hitting the administration's inflation forecast, but a very low probability of obtaining or bettering both the inflation and the unemployment goals of the administration simultaneously. Staff warned, in those terms, that the joint targets were highly unlikely to be met simultaneously. The committee chose a path compatible with them anyway. The deliberative record shows members understood exactly what they were navigating. In February 1982, Lawrence Roos, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, framed the constraint with unusual directness. Quote, "Anything that can be construed as being more expansionary at that time of the year will be interpreted immediately as the Fed caving in to political pressure in view of the November elections." Roos named the political constraint while operating within it. That is not the same as resisting it. The coordination extended beyond individual episodes. By December 1982, Edward Boehner, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, argued for a particular range setting on grounds that went beyond technical monetary analysis, noting that the range would also help to avoid the Fed coming out with one thing and the administration with another. The word avoid is carrying significant weight. It describes an active choice to align, not a coincidental convergence on shared economic readings. Two interpretive readings of this evidence coexist in the archive, and intellectual honesty requires naming both. The more charitable reading is that Roos was doing something closer to resistance than accommodation, naming the political optics precisely in order to argue that the committee should not be seen to respond to them. On that reading,
The salience of the November elections in his framing reflects a concern with the institution's credibility, not a concession to executive preference. Boehner's desire for alignment between Fed and administration communications could similarly reflect a shared macroeconomic judgment, two institutions arriving at compatible positions because the data pointed in the same direction, not because one was deferring to the other. David Eastburn, who attended these same deliberations across two decades, offered testimony that speaks directly to this tension. He never witnessed a decision deliberately slanted for political purposes, though he conceded that timing had sometimes been managed to avoid the impression of political motivation. That concession is precisely the line the archive cannot fully resolve. The documentary record confirms that political timing was explicitly named as a live constraint in closed session, a fact that itself departs from the public architecture's claim that executive preferences were irrelevant to the deliberative process. What the archive has not established with equal confidence is whether that salience produced a substantively different policy path from the one the committee would have chosen on the data alone. The competing explanations, shared macroeconomic judgment, communication discipline, consensus-building dynamics, are not refuted by the transcripts. What the transcripts do establish, and what no charitable reading fully dissolves, is that members' structured deliberation around political timing, while the public record described an institution for which such timing was irrelevant by design. The gap between those two registers is documented. Whether it crossed from salience into substance is the question the evidence supports raising, but does not yet fully answer. The three-way divergence, staff recommending tighter conditions, the committee delaying, public statements maintaining that independence was structurally guaranteed, is the mechanism itself. No single register recorded a formal surrender. The institution was not making a unified decision so much as managing a contradiction, and it managed that contradiction through time. Delays that were always defensible when they ended, accommodations that were never visible in isolation. What the archive has not yet determined is whether this pattern of temporal accommodation was distributed uniformly across the institutional record, or whether it concentrated around specific figures at the head of the table.
The variable in the chair. Accommodation was acknowledged in closed session, filtered from the public record, and temporally calibrated to presidential cycles. Whether the pattern was institutional, distributed evenly across every chair and every era, or concentrated around specific figures, remained open. The archive reveals a pattern consistent with meaningful chair effects. Accommodation was not distributed uniformly across eras, and the transcripts suggest that how political constraints were weighed and discussed varied with the person occupying the chair, though the record alone cannot fully separate leadership style from the different economic conditions each chair confronted. The architecture was constant. The accord, the 14-year terms, the distributed voting structure, none of it changed between Burns's tenure and Volcker's, between Volcker's and Greenspan's. What changed was who sat at the head of the table. During the Martin era, acknowledgement of political constraint was at least candid about its nature. In July 1966, Vice Chairman J. L. Robertson made the operating logic explicit. Quote, "It was necessary to recognize that there was sentiment in the administration against escalation of interest rates and a tendency to view discount rate increases as contributing to such escalation. The system had to have a strong case before risking any enlargement of that feeling." The threshold for action was elevated. The data case had to be strong enough to justify the political cost of acting against administration sentiment. The bar for a strong case was calibrated against political risk as much as against economic conditions. This was not Burns's pathology. It was the institution's ambient practice, operating through the chair's judgment about when the political cost of acting was worth bearing. Burns made that calculus explicit, systematically tilting it toward accommodation. Volcker reversed it, not by changing the architecture, but by refusing to apply the same calibration. Greenspan articulated the governing principle in December 1993, telling the committee that monetary policy had to be isolated from all other issues over which we are going to be on the battlefields, while his own record displayed the same dual register, internal sensitivity paired with public dismissal of political influence that had characterized every prior era. The same dual register phenomenon, officials operating in one rhetorical mode internally and another publicly, was documented in a prior investigation of how individual speakers invoke institutional authority while proposing prescriptions the institution has already tested. Against all of this, Philadelphia Fed President David Eastburn offered a formulation the archive makes difficult to sustain. Quote, "In 2 decades of observing and participating in FOMC deliberations, I never have witnessed a decision deliberately slanted for political purposes." Eastburn attended the same meetings as Robertson, sat in the same room where accommodation was rationalized and timed. His statement is not dishonest. That is precisely the problem. The word deliberately does the structural work of the denial. Accommodation built into the chair's threshold for action, the calculation of when a case is strong enough to risk the administration's displeasure, requires no deliberate slanting. It operates through sincere analytical judgment that systematically aligns with political preference. Eastburn's own record is more revealing than his denial acknowledges. He conceded elsewhere that the timing of decisions had been influenced by a desire to avoid the impression of political motivation, a concession that the architecture's function included navigating executive preferences, not merely ignoring them.
The engine's prescience scoring, which tracks whether specific warnings by named officials were subsequently vindicated by documented outcomes, surfaces a pattern across the dissenting voices in this investigation. Teeter's 1978 warning that outsiders would decode the collision between monetary policy and presidential objectives within seconds was validated by the public and political response to subsequent rate actions. Roos's 1982 warning that any easing near the election would be construed as political capitulation was borne out by the debate that followed the committee's July pivot to lower rates. Though the severity of the recession, with unemployment approaching 11%, meant the easing was independently defensible on macroeconomic grounds. Honig's 1995 warning that transcripts would chill candor was confirmed by the very record the post-reform transcripts produced. In each case, the dissenter identified a mechanism the majority acknowledged privately, but did not act on publicly. The prescience was not about forecasting an economic outcome. It was about forecasting an institutional one. That the gap between what the committee knew and what it said would produce exactly the vulnerability the architecture was built to prevent. The distinction he draws between deliberately slanting a decision and adjusting its timing to manage political optics is the precise distinction the delay mechanism exploits. If timing adjustments systematically aligned policy execution with political calendars, the question is whether they produced a substantively different path from the one the committee would otherwise have taken. If they did, the distinction between deliberate accommodation and optics management does not hold. The transcript record, where members explicitly named political timing as a live constraint while calibrating the pace of action around it, is the archive's answer to that question. The convergence score across registers, 0.35, with 7 supporting documents and 7 contradicting, is not ambiguity. It is an institution in genuine disagreement about whether its own independence is structural or personal. The reforms enacted after each documented failure addressed the architecture. None addressed the chair's threshold. The accord could not bind a chair who set the bar for action by political cost. Transparency norms could not bind a chair who rationalized accommodation as data dependence. The safeguards are shields available to be picked up, not walls that stand independently of whoever stands behind them, and whether any reform has changed this is the question the evidence has now made unavoidable. The shield they built.
The finding that independence depended on the character of the chair rather than the architecture of the institution is what the archive's reform record bears most directly upon. Not because each major reform was designed to address that specific vulnerability, but because each altered the institutional environment in which that vulnerability operated. The 1951 Accord was driven by the need to end direct Treasury command over monetary conditions. Humphrey Hawkins, by congressional demands for numerical accountability. The transcript decision, as the archive documents, by a collapsed legal position after the Justice Department's 1993 FOIA policy shift and relentless House Banking Committee pressure. The 2% inflation target by the internal judgment that explicit commitment was necessary to anchor expectations and make forward guidance credible. Their motivations were distinct. Their collective effect was to narrow the discretionary space in which chair-level accommodation had previously operated. The record of that correction is genuine. The 1951 Accord ended the arrangement by which the Federal Reserve served as the Treasury's residual buyer, removing the most direct mechanism of executive command over monetary conditions. Humphrey Hawkins created formal accountability requirements, binding numerical commitments to congressional testimony. The October 1993 decision to preserve and eventually publish FOMC transcripts, resisted for years by a committee that understood what a documentary record would do to deliberation, created the closest thing to structural accountability the institution had ever imposed on itself. The 2012 adoption of an explicit 2% inflation target anchored expectations against the discretionary softening that had characterized earlier accommodations. Each of these was a response to a documented failure, and each accomplished something real. The reader's instinct is not wrong. The institution learned. The transcript decision was the most ambitious reform, a permanent public record imposing on future participants the discipline that personal character had proved insufficient to guarantee. The institution was substituting a structural constraint for the personal one Burns had exposed as inadequate. Greenspan understood immediately what the reform would accomplish, and what else it would accomplish. Quote, release of videotape, audiotape, or a literal transcript would have a chilling effect on the free flow of ideas. The warning was specific and analytical. Transparency would discipline participants, but discipline and candor are not the same constraint. What the reform would purchase in accountability, it would spend in spontaneity. Greenspan's prediction was confirmed 18 months later, not by a critic, but by a participant who had lived through the transition. Quote, I believe the tape has had some chilling effect on our discussions. I see a lot more people reading their statements. I think it is harder to be as candid as some of us might otherwise be. The reform had worked. It had produced exactly what it promised, a record to which participants were accountable. What it had also produced was a reduction in the spontaneity visible in the formal record. Whether unguarded deliberation continued elsewhere, in pre-meeting exchanges, in the margins of conversations the transcript cannot follow, the archive cannot determine. The record documents the constraint on what was said in the room. It cannot document what, if anything, filled the space that constraint created. This internal acknowledgement of reduced candor never entered the public account. The institution's public framing of transparency described a mechanism that strengthened independence without acknowledging the evidentiary trade it enacted simultaneously. And whether any adjustment to the publication lag or the disclosure regime could close that trade is a question the archive raises but does not answer. The 2019 transcripts are the most recent evidence available under the full modern framework, and they demonstrate the consequence. Rosengren, in closed session, was explicit about what the committee was managing. Quote, I have also been surprised by how many journalists have attributed recent changes in Fed speeches as being responsive to political pressures. A public perception that the FOMC is unduly responsive to market or political pressures is clearly undesirable, now and in the future.
The political pressure was visible enough that journalists were writing about it. The committee discussed that visibility in closed session. The public statement made no reference to it. By July, when the first rate cut was taken, Esther George dissented on grounds that the data did not warrant the action.
The economy was growing above trend, labor markets were healthy, consumers were spending, marking the outer boundary of what an unmediated reading of the staff analysis could have justified. The 2019 episode does not resolve cleanly into a filtering case. Staff technical work and public communications showed strong alignment on trade policy uncertainty as a genuine economic rationale for the rate adjustment. Slowing global growth, manufacturing weakness, and the drag from unresolved trade disputes were extensively documented in the board materials and featured prominently in the public statement. The macro case for the cut was analytically defensible on its own terms, and the evidence does not establish that the public rationale was a cover for political accommodation. What the 2019 transcripts do establish is that a defensible economic rationale and documented concern about political perception coexisted in the same deliberative space, and that the political perception dimension, named explicitly in closed session, did not surface in the public account. Rosengren's closed session concern about political perception and George's data-based dissent together mark the boundary of what the full modern transparency framework was able to surface publicly. Internal unease about the political environment was named in the room, and a dissent grounded in the staff's own reading of domestic conditions was entered in the record, but neither entered the public account of the decision. The significance is not that the public rationale was false, it was not, but that the framework built to document the full range of deliberative considerations documented only part of them. The escalation from that documented unease to what followed required 6 years. By January 2026, the mechanism had shifted from journalistic attribution to legal instrument. The Department of Justice served the Federal Reserve with grand jury subpoenas targeting the chair's congressional testimony. The committee's 2019 concern about the perception of political responsiveness, discussed in closed session, absent from the public record, had become a federal judge's finding that the subpoena's dominant purpose was to pressure the chair on rate decisions. The transparency framework that documented Rosengren's private concern could not prevent the escalation it implicitly warned about. The archive, designed to hold future participants accountable, had produced precisely what Greenspan predicted and Honig confirmed. Participants who knew the record would eventually be read wrote for its future readers. The Burns-era transcripts are candid because those in the room expected no one would see them. The 2019 transcripts are carefully managed because everyone in the room knew someone eventually would. The archive is most legible as a witness to the era it was never designed to document, and least legible in the era it was built precisely to serve. And no achievable adjustment to the publication lag or the disclosure regime closes that gap, because the gap is not procedural.
The circuit the investigation has now completed leads back to the insulation Burns described, the architecture Meltzer praised, and the experience Eastburn testified to. And the archive illuminates all three without vindicating any of them fully. Burns was correct that Congress built the structure to insulate the central bank from political pressure. Meltzer was correct that the architecture provides genuine protection. Eastburn was likely correct about what he witnessed. Deliberations were not nakedly steered. What the archive adds is the layer beneath the testimony, the candid acknowledgments in session after session that the pressure was present, the systematic filtration of those acknowledgments before they reached the public, the temporal patterns in policy outcomes that traced the contours of political calendars, and the finding that the architecture's effectiveness depended heavily on the willingness of a single official to use it. The reforms the institution built in response to each documented failure were real. The transparency framework, the explicit mandate, the publication lag, each attenuated the vulnerability the prior era had exposed, and each left residual vulnerabilities the archive documented with characteristic precision and described to the public with characteristic restraint. The archive does not show an institution captured. It does not show an institution immune. It shows an institution that has spent 7 decades managing a tension it cannot eliminate, documenting that management in transcripts released 5 years after the fact, and describing the management in real time as resolution.
Independence is not a condition the Federal Reserve achieved in 1951 and has maintained by institutional inertia. It is a condition the institution actively reproduces, meeting by meeting, chair by chair. And the archive is the record of that reproduction, including the meetings where it fell short. The March 2026 ruling that quashed the subpoenas confirmed the architecture's capacity to hold. But the holding required a federal judge, a Senate Banking Committee member who blocked the successor nomination, and a chair who released an extraordinary public video. Three actors outside the Fed's own institutional machinery performed the function the architecture claims as internal. The insulation held. It did not hold from the inside. This has been the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine at causalityineconomics.com. Every claim in this article can be verified through the engine's semantic search across 90 years of Federal Reserve documents.